Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, this is episode 335. Welcome back to the show. I hope you thoroughly enjoyed Brother Aquilina's guest host last week. I've invited several guest hosts to come on the program and host the show, many of whom own their own podcasts and Masonic media. So hopefully you will be enjoying that. And next week, I've got another guest host who will be on the program, which should be really amazing as well. In the news this week, I did want to mention just a few things right off the top. We found a new hashtag on Facebook, and I thought it was pretty interesting. My good friend and brother, Brother Scott Duball, I should say Right Worshipful Brother Scott Duball, recently started a hashtag, 7 days, 7 books. Now, in the past, I'm sure many of you have been on social media and you've seen some of the posts for like 7 days, 7 black and white photographs or whatever have you. And those were really fun. They gave us a little bit of a glimpse into what our friends were seeing around and maybe an artistic look at things. But this is a little different. It's all about Masonic education. And so if you see the hashtag out there and somebody tags you, you should do it. It's pretty fun. It's Let's Make Masonic Education Go Viral. Hashtag 7 days, 7 books. And I recently was nominated by Scott. So my post says, I was nominated by Scott Duball. Here's how it works. Each day, post a photo of a book you enjoy. Tag a bro to nominate or challenge him to participate. Let's see how long we can keep this going. Day one, for me, was The Lost Word and its Hidden Meaning, a correlation of the allegory and symbolism of the Bible with that of Freemasonry, and an exposition of The Secret by George H. Steinmetz and Joseph Krieger. And I nominated a good friend of mine, Brother Spencer Hammond, Right Worshipful Brother Spencer Hammond, I should say. Let's be proper, I guess. So if somebody tags you out there, or if you see mine and you want to start your own, just do it. Man, let's go nuts with the Masonic books. Let's spread the Masonic education all around. I also want to mention that just a couple weeks back, Ronald Seal, the Grand Commander for the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite, had written a wonderful piece inside of the Scottish Rite magazine, and if you didn't get a chance to read that, you really should. And in fact, he follows it up this month with another amazing piece that he talks about some things. Namely, he talks about some of the shortcuts and what our lodges have done and our appendant bodies have done in order to make Freemasonry more appealing, in order to make it more quick, anything you can do. And he really kind of talks about how it's cheapening things, but then, you know, he kind of digresses and talks a little bit about what it's really about. And we really shouldn't be out there trying to manufacture this kind of brotherhood. So definitely check that out. I'll try to put a link in the show notes so that you can go download that issue right from their website. And just, if you do nothing else, just read his message for the month. Also in the news, I really want to mention the Illinois Lodge of Research is having its Spring Symposium, and it's coming up real soon on Saturday, March 24th at 8 a.m., and it's going to go until 4 p.m. Check-in is at 8 a.m. It's at Homer Masonic Temple in Homer, Illinois. They're going to have check-in again at 8 o'clock. There'll be some coffee and donuts, standard good stuff. Lunch and refreshments, that's going to be $15, okay? And we can just pay at the door, so no big deal there. And again, this is going to be sponsored by the Illinois Lodge of Research and Homer Lodge number 199 AFNAM. This is titled, What Lies Beyond Illinois Freemasonry? And I would like to just read the little blurb they have here on the Facebook site. It says, the Illinois Lodge of Research and Homer Lodge 199 AFNAM announced the first of two Masonic educational symposiums for our Illinois Lodge of Research 2018 symposium series entitled What Lies Beyond Illinois Freemasonry. This is an all-day event. The headline speaker is going to be Worshipful Brother Ben Wallace, who will talk about the traditional observance Masonic Lodge. It's also going to feature speakers on many aspects of esoteric Freemasonry, other fraternal organizations, and their success with millennials and other interesting topics. So again, lunch is going to be served, and I think it's going to be just a really great meeting. I'm going to have to miss this one, unfortunately. Pains me, much as I love Masonic education. But if you find the Illinois Lodge of Research on Facebook, go to their events, and you can grab the Eventbrite ticket right there. And the tickets are free, so you don't need anything else or any other reason to go. This week, we've got a really nice piece by illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison for the Masonic Minute. I know you are going to enjoy the heck out of this one. I read the title and I got immediately excited. This really should have been on last week's episode. However, I did not want to interrupt Brother Jack's awesome piece that he put together. So, that said, we've got that coming up. We've got a couple of the good pieces this week, including one that was written back in 1938. It seemed to be pretty interesting. Just a quick shout out to the Blue Lounge Social Club here in Illinois, who our chapter president and vice president, so Bobby Mitchell and Tyler Edens, actually hosted the Brought to Light podcast, which was pretty awesome. If you have a minute, you want to check that out, please do so. They did a great job. And now we're going to get right into our first piece for this week, and then we'll go right into the Masonic Minute. The first piece for this week is called An Ennobling Science, and it's from the Masonic Craftsman, written back in 1938. Freemasonry has its bitter enemies and its doubting despisers. There are some who have formed the opinion that it was created as a substitute for religion, whereas it is only the handmaid to her fair graces. Others presume the labors of Masons are trifling, absurd mysteries, or profane mummeries, whereas there is no subject existing within the range and grasp of the human intellect that which the science of Freemasonry does not enter in the pursuit of wisdom and knowledge. Some ridicule the secrets of Freemasons, declaring them to be either hurtful to society or wrong in themselves, whereas those secrets are bonds of their mutual fidelity by which they pledge themselves to, quote-unquote, trace wisdom and follow virtue. Time was when the members of the craft were denounced and dangerous, and every man of eminence known to be a Mason was called upon to renounce his connection with our social activities. But in the face of all opposition, the fraternity remained calm, and the sun of Masonry has dispersed the clouds which darkened her sky so long. Without terrestrial possessions, without any coercing power titan that of morality and virtue, Freemasonry has survived the wreck of mighty empires and resisted the destroying hand of time. No other institution can be compared with it. Every other society sinks into insignificance when placed by the side of Masonry, Christianity alone excepted. Like Gray's virtuous peasant, Freemasonry keeps the noiseless tenor of its way and rejoices in the unsullied happiness of doing good. When did Freemasonry first begin to exist, and why has the institution been thus preserved? Masons' work began with the creation. To understand the measures of weight and light and sound, to unravel, seize upon, and comprehend those unchanging laws by which the earth, the sun, the moon, the planet are sustained in space, to follow up the changes of seasons, and in every step of the investigation as to the intellect climbed from lofty truths to truths still more lofty, to pause in profound admiration, to feel the Creator close to the creature, and to adore. This was the first aim of Masonry. This, its task. Ever fresh, never ended, a science teeming with new results and adding incentive after incentive to praise and glorify the grand architect of the universe. Freemasonry has been preserved because it instructs its members to worship the Almighty Maker, to honor and obey the sovereign of the country, to be peaceful in their stations, diligent in their callings, honest in their dealings, respectful toward their superiors, gentle and condescending to their inferiors, merciful toward their enemies, kind and obliging in all the duties of their common life. Such is the institution which has been preserved to the world, unlimited in its numbers, and scattered over every land and kingdom. The work of the fraternity today is to be true to the original character of the order, to continue to follow the God of nature through all the wonderful variety of his works, and to keep the silence and above, and observe the sacred rules imposed upon the craft. It might be said by some scoffer, if Masonry be such a pure and ennobling science, should not all Masons be wise and good and temperate, and self-denying, full of piety and good words? The answer is that the fitness of any system is not to be tried and condemned because of unworthiness in some. If any man has been led by the impatient curiosity without higher motive to place unhallowed feet on the tessellated pavement, if any has turned the hallowed purposes of Masonry into mere convivial meetings, if any has been content with merely acquiring superficial acquaintance with the craft, let not the system itself be charged with their preservation. Let their sins, or their folly, an unworthy brother would perhaps have been a worse man if he had not been a Mason.
It seems almost any high-profile mystery brings conspiracy theorists out of the woodwork with at least one angle pointing to the Freemasons. From the street patterns of Washington, D.C., to alleged Masonic symbolism on the dollar bill, to the Kennedy assassination, there are those who would put the Freemasons behind it. Not surprisingly, then, is the belief by some that the Jack the Ripper slayings of the late 19th century, also known as the Whitechapel murders, were a devious Masonic plot. There are varying accounts as to how the Masons were involved, as is usually the case when speculators don't let facts get in the way of their theories. They all, however, identify Sir William Gull as the infamous Ripper. Gull appears as Jack the Ripper in books, movies, and countless internet posts, including the 1988 TV adaptation Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution, and the 2000 graphic novel From Hell. Subsequently, the Hollywood movie From Hell, starring Johnny Depp, was loosely based on the novel. William Withy Gull was a respected physician credited with many significant contributions to medicine, including advancements in the diagnosis and treatment of Bright's disease, myxedema, and paraplegia. He also named the devastating eating disorder anorexia nervosa. He became personal physician to Queen Victoria and the royal family. The conspiracy theory and premise of the movie, which parallels most of the Ripper Masonic theories, begins with the historical inaccuracy of Prince Edward Albert contracting syphilis. This allegedly tarnishes Gull's reputation as the prince's physician because Gull was unable to treat him. Gull, portrayed as a Freemason in the film, takes it upon himself to eradicate the prostitutes that caused the prince's affliction. He does this by murdering the prostitutes with the implication they are ritual killings associated with the Freemasons. Not to leave any stone unturned, the movie also depicts the prince as taking on the identity of Walter Sickert. Sickert, rather than being an alias for the prince, was in fact a 19th century painter. Some believe he once lived in Jack the Ripper's apartment, a speculation likely due to the fact one of his paintings was titled Jack the Ripper's Bedroom. To be sure, historically, Prince Edward Albert and Sickert were separate individuals. But in the movie, the prince becomes Sickert and marries Anne Crook, taking her away from her life as a prostitute. Together, the prince and Anne have a daughter, Alice. By English law, therefore, Alice becomes an heir to the throne, and the film surmises Queen Victoria ordered that this problem be eliminated. Gull, as the Ripper, takes it upon himself to do so in a far more grisly way than Queen Victoria had intended. In the movie, Gull is portrayed by Ian Holm, who was, at the time of filming, 68 years old and in good health. His character is spry enough to carry out the brutal and physical murders. The five murders attributed to the Ripper happened between August and November 1888, when Gull was 72. The previous year, Dr. Gull's health began to decline. He suffered a series of strokes and a heart attack that, by the time of the murders, had rendered him unable to commit the crimes. The London Times reported Gull's first stroke paralyzed him, and he was never able to resume his practice. Dr. Gull died of a final stroke January 29, 1890. The final Whitechapel murder occurred after his death, although authorities did not conclusively attribute it to Jack the Ripper. Whether or not that final killing was the Ripper's, the facts are certain that Gull was not Jack the Ripper, nor were the murders some sort of Masonic ritual. One final thing. There is not a shred of evidence that Dr. William Gull was a Freemason. for the Whence Came You podcast. This is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that awesome Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. We should have another here in a couple weeks or whenever he gets around to it. We're just so grateful that he's able to provide us with these amazing segments. And if you like these, remember they're videos most of the time, and you can find those on Steve's YouTube channel, and we also publish them on the Whence Came You channel, typically the day before the podcast releases or the day of. Speaking of videos, I would like to take just a moment here to remind you guys out there that we did start a YouTube channel called Masonic Curators. The goal and the aim of this is not to have me on every day like usually happens talking about Masonic items that we've collected, but I really would love for you guys to record something. And again, if you guys go ahead and do that, I will try my hardest to edit the video or do whatever you need to have it done to put your story up on the channel. We've got a great number of subscribers already. We just want to grow that. We want to make sure that you guys are liking and subscribing to the channel. And really the goal here is to preserve the stories behind some of our objects. Now, whether that's a coin, you can tell us about the manufacture of the coin. You can tell us the story of how you got the coin or where you were when you got it. Just tell the story of the item. And that's what we're really looking for. We want to know what makes it personal for you, what makes it neat to you. And so whether that's an antique that you just bought or somebody gave you or you inherited or whatever the case is, go ahead, record it just on your cell phone even. You can upload it to Google Drive. If you don't know how to do that, contact me. I'll help you, and we'll get your story on Masonic Curators. So just go to MasonicCurators.com, and you can see the submission guidelines in their full context there. And again, contact me with any questions you have. I'd love to get your stuff on the channel. And before we get into the next piece as well, I just want to take a moment to thank everybody out there who is a monthly contributor. Those of you out there who are buying our lapel pins and the tie bars and money clips, cufflinks, all that, it is so appreciated. And I do have to say that I need to address a little issue we had. I received notice that a few of the pins got to you guys who ordered them and the stems were bent. And you guys said, most of you anyway, said, no worries, I'm just going to bend it back real gentle and it's no big deal. And what was happening was we were shipping these out in the nice envelopes that we do, the typical way, but the mail service just runs these pins through like a roller system and it was bending these things. We had no idea. So in order to stop that, we have to package the pin a little bit better. And so we have to charge a little bit more for shipping. I'm bummed about it. Shipping used to be $2 anywhere in the U.S., and then we had to switch it over to now it's $3.50. But it's flat rate, it's always going to be the same, and it really isn't going to get more expensive. And if you buy two different items the same day or whatever, I will likely refund one of your shipping costs, just so you know. I don't have a real great way of bringing the cart together so that you can check out just once. So that being said, please understand the reason for the increased $1.50 on shipping, but that will enable us to get the pin to you. It's a nice package that comes kind of classically done, and I think you guys will really enjoy it. It's an experience to open rather than just ripping the envelope open and pulling out your pin. So thanks again for your understanding with that. Speaking of sponsors, I just want to remind everybody that Alpha Brain has got, I think, a free trial coming up here. So we have a sponsorship through Onnit. So I always talked about Alpha Brain. It's awesome. And now I think they have a free trial coming up. So check out their Facebook page or anything that we post on Facebook relating to Onnit. You can click through those links, get your Alpha Brain. I think it's a free trial. And then anytime you order a free trial, I think they send us a kickback also. So that's pretty cool. Know that it is a really great product and I've used it several years now. Check that out. We also have several other ways to support the show. So just go to wcypodcast.com, hover over support the show, and check out your different options there. We do appreciate everything because every dollar that we raise goes right back into the production of this show, and it keeps the hosting going so that even when the show ends at some point in the future, the episodes will be available forever or until the funds run out, right? Which at that point, I'm sure we'll come up with some way to keep it around. But let's go right into our next piece right now. This piece is originally from the Midnight Freemasons, and we published it a few weeks ago. In fact, it had a really good catch, and Brother Darren A. Lonners, Worshipful Brother Darren A. Lonners, wrote kind of a follow-up to it, which we might tackle in another episode, but for this one, it's The Importance of a Good Reputation, and it's by Midnight Freemason founder Todd E. Kreese in 33rd Degree. It takes many good deeds to build a good reputation, and only one bad one to lose it. Benjamin Franklin. One thing that was pounded into young men of my generation was the importance of building a good reputation. It's hard work because your reputation is the public reflection of your character. It is what other people see and come to believe about you. It's based on what you do. It's based on what you say. It's based on how you act. It's based on how you treat other people and how you make other people feel. There are few things more important than reputation when it comes to our successes or our failures as a person. It can take years to build a reputation. It can take mere seconds to destroy it. It is something we should be very deliberate about building and very careful about protecting because it is the essence of who we are. And it's very difficult to rebuild a reputation after you've allowed it to become tarnished. I don't deserve the reputation I have. I hear that a lot. It's very rarely ever true. You see, you can have a few people in your life that have an unfavorable opinion of you. Everyone does. But your reputation is what most people that know you think of you. If you have a reputation of being opinionated and outspoken, chances are you're opinionated and outspoken. If you have a reputation for being undependable, you're probably undependable. Sometimes people don't think that's fair. But reputation is based on a very sound principle. It's based on your past behavior. And any employer or supervisor will tell you that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. I'm going to say what I want to say and do what I want to do. And I don't really care what other people think. I hear that one a lot too. Sounds very tough and defiant, but actually it's a childish attitude to have. That selfish and narcissistic attitude demonstrates a complete lack of care or concern for other people, most specifically those that you love and care about you. Your reputation reflects on you, sure, but you don't think it also reflects on your spouse or your kids, your family, your community, your church, your fraternity, your employer. You've never heard anybody say, "She's a real nice lady, but her husband is a real jerk." You've never heard somebody say, "I don't know why he hangs around with that guy. He'd steal the shirt right off your back." Of course you have. Your actions affect everyone around you, whether that's your intention or not. Building a solid reputation is hard because it requires an amazing amount of self-discipline. It requires us to learn from our mistakes and not to continue to repeat them. Those are the lessons that mature into wisdom eventually. It requires us to learn when it is important for us to speak and when it's better to remain silent. It requires us to listen to others and respect their point of view. It requires us to admit when we are wrong and to apologize when it's appropriate. It requires us to be truthful and honest in all of our dealings. It requires us to do the things we say we're going to do regardless of how difficult the task may be. Men of good reputation and solid character used to be more common than they are today. We don't teach the value of it anymore. Our society is so focused inward on ourselves and our own selfish needs, we are a society of grown children fighting and arguing on social media just like children used to fight and argue on the playground. We've never grown up and become men because we haven't had the role models. And just like children, we don't think about what we're saying, and we don't think about what our words and actions are saying about us. We'd all be better off if we worked a lot harder at building ourselves as decent human beings rather than focusing so intently on satisfying our own needs. And those of us who are able should focus on not only modeling those honorable character traits, but teaching others to be men of good character, men of good report, men of unquestioned reputation. Todd E. Kreese, originally published on the From Labor to Refreshment blog, January 9th, 2018. All right, I hope you enjoyed that piece as well. Some super important words, and I think contemplating and reading that is actually something that we might all do well. Maybe read it again or listen to it again. It serves to be this almost inner reflection and also serves to help us understand the boundary of our circles. It helps us to understand when we should not say something. Now, I've struggled with that personally on a number of occasions, so that's something I try to think about quite often. I question almost everything I post these days, and as you should. I mean, this is social media, and we publish things and the public can view them. And the last thing we want to do is tarnish reputations or make people dislike us based on something we've posted rather than maybe our deeds or whatever else. Just some things to think about. So the other day, I found out that my son's teacher took a half day because she went with her family to go see a movie, The Dark Crystal. Now, The Dark Crystal, if you are unfamiliar, is a wonderful epic done by Jim Henson and Frank Oz, yes, Yoda, and it's a fantastic movie done with puppets, and it was really great. It was just a fantastic thing that I saw when I was a kid, and they re-released it in theaters, and it's coming back out on Netflix, I guess, and I thought that was really cool, so I decided to watch it again with my kids, and it was just kind of interesting. Looking back now, I probably hadn't watched it since I've been a Freemason, and that's been about 10 years, and one symbol that kind of stuck out to me, we talk about a lot of the symbols inside of the movies and comic books, pop culture and things, and I don't know, it just kind of stuck out, but there's an opening in this crystal castle, and it's a Delta, and then there's three suns that converge. So it's like three suns, so the three points within a delta. It was pretty neat, definitely kind of symbolic, but probably just a bit of me seeing what I wanted to see. Anyway, the final piece we have for this week is called Continental Freemasonry Before AD 1723 by Oliver D. Street and the American Freemason, published February of 1914. The orthodox view at the present time is that Freemasonry was introduced from England on the continent of Europe about AD 1725. The first impulse, therefore, of the informed reader will perhaps be to exclaim, "What is he talking about? Does he not know that prior to 1723 there was no such thing as Freemasonry on the continent?" I reply at once that I know nothing of the sort, nor does anyone else. A few decades ago, Masonic writers were very knowing as they conceived as to what the facts of Masonic history were. Today, we are equally cocksure that we know that they were not. The silence of the relatively few documents which have escaped destruction down to our time concerning any fact or custom relating to Freemasonry is, with many of our most respected Masonic historians, sufficient ground for the rejection altogether of such a fact or custom. Negative evidence of this kind is held by them to far outweigh all our oral and written traditions. It is, or should be well known, that negative evidence of the character is of little value. Thus, we glibly assert that before AD 1717, lodges had no authority for meeting except the inherent right of Masons to meet anywhere and at any time, and there make Masons and transact Masonic business. That prior to 1717, there was no Grand Master and no Grand Lodge. That prior to 1724, there was no Master Mason degree. That prior to 1740, there was no Royal Arch. And finally, prior to 1725, there was no Freemasonry on the continent of Europe. It is to the last statement that I desire to call attention once more. It is directly contrary to the written traditions of the craft as recorded on the so-called old charges, certainly for nearly 500 years. These, with practically one accord, tell us that Freemasonry existed upon the continent before it did in England. It is not, however, on this body of evidence I wish to dwell, but to introduce a statement found in Anderson's Constitutions, published in 1723, which, if it cannot be explained away somehow, seems to establish the existence of Freemasonry on the continent in 1723 and prior thereto. In the first edition of Anderson's Constitutions is published the charges of a Freemason, extracted from the ancient records of lodges beyond sea, and of those in England, Scotland, and Ireland, etc., etc. In the quote-unquote approbation of this work signed by the Grand Master, Deputy Grand Master, Grand Wardens, and the Masters and Wardens of 20 particular lodges, it is explicitly stated that the author had quote-unquote examined several copies from Italy. This book was compiled and published by direction and authority of the Grand Lodge itself. The statement above, quoted plainly, declare that in 1723, and imply that much earlier, there was in existence on the continent an institution which the Grand Lodge of England and its officers then recognized as identical with their own Freemasonry. These passages from Anderson I have never seen subjected to analysis or criticism by any of our Masonic historians, but it would seem to require some temerity for writers of the present day, nearly 200 years after the event, to maintain that these Masons of 1723 did not know what they were talking about. It does not appear likely that these references are to lodges recently credited in Europe either by the British Masonic authorities or by Freemasons of British origin acting on their own responsibility, because 1. We have no evidence of the introduction of British Freemasonry on the continent prior to 1725, and 2. The customs and usages of such lodges would not have been regarded as authoritative in the mother country, and their records could scarcely have been called ancient. A common sense interpretation of the passages above quoted would seem to require either that we date much farther back than has heretofore been supposed the introduction of British Freemasonry on the continent, or that we admit the existence there of an indigenous Freemasonry of its own. The only escape from this conclusion is to suppose that Anderson has inadvertently said what he did not mean, or else that he has deliberately falsified. I know it is quite the fashion lately to brush aside with a sneer anything from Anderson that happens not to coincide with one's views. Few have had the boldness to charge him with conscious falsehood, but his credulity, real and supposed, has been employed on all sorts of occasions to get rid of any troublesome statements made by him. Nothing in his life or character so far is known warrants the charge of falsehood. As for inadvertence, it must be borne in mind that Anderson's work was twice approved by the Grand Lodge, once by a committee of distinguished brethren after making some minor corrections, and finally by the Grand Master, Deputy Grand Master, Grand Wardens, and the Masters and Wardens of 20 particular lodges. Then there is the explicit statement about quote-unquote several copies from Italy. It is too much to suppose that all of these brethren were ignoramuses or frauds. So far as Anderson undertook to record the history and traditions of the craft in times prior to his own, he cannot be regarded otherwise than as a mere compiler. He does not himself profess more. In fact, he was not instructed to do more. This he seems to have done with much embellishment and little discrimination. Students of Masonry are no doubt correct in accepting these portions of his writing with hesitation. But it seems that distinct and positive statements made by him as to contemporaneous events, or as to records examined by him and these statements approved by the leading Masons of his time, stand on an entirely different footing. To overthrow these, something better than mere surmise should be forthcoming. Brother Robert F. Gould, though holding to the belief that all Freemasonry has sprung from Great Britain, admits that in the short space from 10 to 20 years after the establishment of the Grand Lodge of England, Freemasonry had, quote-unquote, obtained a firm footing in the remotest parts of the continent of Europe. History, Volume 3, page 77. That, quote, wherever the earliest lodges existed, there we find traces of previous meetings. That in the first stated lodges, there were present undoubted Masons initiated elsewhere. History, page 78. In other words, this distinguished Masonic historian of the most exacting school admits, in effect, that we know not when or where the first Masonic meetings were held upon the continent, nor whence hailed the Masons who held them. That is to say, Freemasonry has existed there from a time when the memory of man runneth not to the contrary, or from time immemorial. This is in precise accord with our traditions. It is true Brother Gould attempts to account for the undoubted presence and general dissemination of the continent so soon after the revival of Freemasons made we know not where, by what can be regarded as no more than a very doubtful hypothesis. His theory is that at this period, around A.D. 1717, England enjoyed great prominence in the eyes of Europe because of her wealth, her possession of Hanover, and the recent victories of Marlborough, and that in consequence of these things, thousands of visitors flocked to her capital, that they were attracted to the lodges by the fact that they saw them attended by noblemen of high position and men celebrated for their learning, that returning to their own countries they carried Freemasonry with them, and then, asks Brother Gould, quote, what more natural than that? Those debarred from visiting our shores should desire to benefit by the new whim of those eccentric islanders, and that given a sufficient number of initiated in any one town, lodge should be formed. It must be admitted that not often do nations exhibit such immediate and remarkable enthusiasm for the new and strange institutions of another nation. It would seem a more reasonable explanation, and one harmonizing with our traditions, that Freemasonry was an institution not wholly unknown to the Continentals, though perhaps decadent, and differing much from that of England, that the new impetus given to the craft in England by the events called the quote-unquote revival was also felt upon the continent by kindred institutions already existing there, resulting in a development and growth similar to that which occurred in England. We know that kindred institutions did then exist and had existed there from time immemorial, namely the Steinmetzen of Germany, the Compagnonnage of France, and the Magistri Comanche of Italy, and in all those countries the craft guilds, and, alongside them, and having much the same membership, the craft fraternities. And the indications are numerous that all these institutions, as well as Freemasonry, trace back to the Collegia Fabrorum of Roman Empire. If this be true, it would be remarkable indeed if Freemasonry or a society substantially the same should have existed only in remote Britain. It must be obvious to the student of Masonic history that the last word has not yet been said concerning the origin of Freemasonry on the continent. It is possible that both our English and certain of our German brethren who have been claiming for their respective countries the exclusive distinction of having been the sole preserver of the Masonic institution will be forced to recognize not only the share of each other in this work, but even that of France and Italy. All right, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the program. We tried to mix a great episode together for you this week with some history, some opinion, and something to learn by. If you enjoy Masonic podcasts, I know you do, you're listening to this one, go ahead and check out the Masonic Roundtable, which goes live every Tuesday night at 10, 9 Central. This upcoming Tuesday, if you're listening to this on March 11th, you don't want to miss TMR on March 13th. We're going to have Apathy, who is a brother out of Connecticut, on the show, and he's going to be talking a little bit about his brand of masonry, his new album, and a bunch of really cool stuff. So if you haven't had a chance, you want to check that out. Please don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons, publishing 3 articles a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And of course, Masonic Curators, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And if we get a bunch of people start making these things, we can release every single day. Now, these are short videos, like 5 minutes or less usually, so please check those out. Again, MasonicCurators.com, check them out on YouTube. And remember, this show, if you're not into the podcast, you like to pull it up on YouTube. If you manage your subscriptions there, every episode of this program goes out to YouTube as well. So you can definitely get the show however you want to absorb it. With all that, thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys have an amazing week, and we'll be back next week with a special guest host. And until then, stay on the level. For Wentz Gamu, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.